Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Mystery Backroads. We're your hosts, Mike and Dan. And in this podcast, we will explore lesser-known stories, legends, people, and places of the Buckeye State. So buckle in, here we go.
And welcome to another episode of Ohio Mysteries Backroads. In today's episode, we explore one of the most unique airplane collections ever assembled. This collection grew out of one man's drive and passion and would come to attract worldwide attention and even cause pilots to change their flight paths to just sneak a peek at these rare aircraft. With me in this podcast is my partner, Mike. Mike, hello. How are you?
Dan, I'm doing great. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
So tell me more about this guy and his airplanes.
Yes, the guy in the story, his name was Walter Saplata, and he lived quite a life. He was the son of Czech immigrants, and he grew up in modest means in Cleveland, Ohio. Walter had an undying passion for airplanes, and as a young man, he would scrimp and save just to buy balsa wood to build model airplanes by hand. He painstakingly saved every model airplane he ever built until tragically a fire would wipe out his first ever airplane collection.
So that was his first collection, now the one that got wiped out.
Yes, yes. Walter started early and soon the aviation bug would really sink in. When World War II broke out, Walter was deemed unfit for service due to a stutter. He also left formal schooling by the eighth grade, but found work as a carpenter and a welder in a junkyard. In fact, it was said that the welding job provided scrap wood that Walter would scrounge piece by piece until he had constructed the first family home for his wife and growing family. One of the tasks he was assigned to as a welder was to cut up surplus military equipment returning from the war effort. And oftentimes, Walter had to destroy fighter airplanes and aircraft engines, and soon he began to realize how quickly these planes were disappearing, and he decided to do something about it.
So this guy was a scrapper from an early age.
Yes, yes, he sure was. And by this time, Walter had purchased a plot of land in Newberry, Ohio. It's a suburb of Cleveland in northern Ohio. And it was on this land that he constructed the house out of the scrap wood. And something really must have clicked inside him. And one day in 1947, he bought an airplane. Now, Walter didn't know how to fly. In fact, he would never fly an airplane, but he loved airplanes. He loved aviation. Walter would tow the late 1920s American Eagle biplane to his property, and he soon began to collect airplanes one by one until eventually he had amassed an impressive collection with over 20 airplanes and 50 engines. Largely through sheer will and determination, Walter single-handedly began to collect these airplanes, often paying a few hundred dollars for these airplanes that really nobody else wanted. Walter's kids, four daughters and a son, often joined in and securing these airplanes, and soon their efforts became a whole family affair. Walter's son, Wally, has even written a book detailing the often Herculean efforts to transport these airplanes from start to finish.
So were these workable airplanes that he was buying?
Absolutely not. In fact, generally, the planes were never in flyable condition by the time Walter got a hold of them. He had to figure out a way to dismantle and transport these things on a 1950 Chevy Suburban towing a homemade trailer constructed from a chassis of an old moving van. Walter would take all efforts to dismantle these planes with minimal damage, but sometimes it was just necessary to break out the cutting torch. Adding to that, he had to imagine and engineer ways to block, brace, cut, and then load these often massive heavy planes onto his homemade trailer and then drive home on bald tires and faulty brakes, all while tending to his five kids. He would often accomplish all of this in a weekend and be back to work on Monday. Walter modified an old school bus by cutting off the back, leaving only the open chassis to be used to haul these planes.
So did his lovely wife have anything to say about his growing collection?
Well, curiously enough, maybe not as much as one might think. Walter's wife respected his hard work and his drive. She was said to only have gotten upset once when Walter did not tell her in advance, and her first clue was said to be seeing one of the blue outboard wings of an airplane coming down the dirt road on the trailer behind the old clunker Chevy. Mrs. Zaplata would say that when women at her church would ask her why she puts up with her husband's collection, her standard reply was, "At least I always know where my husband is." The year 1966 appeared to be the time when military administrators suddenly discovered they no longer had the World War II aircraft for the air museums they were building. Navy and Marine Corps representatives came by the Zaplata house, and they were all but begging for his FG-12 Corsair, and Zaplata coolly refused.
Wow, so he turned down the military. Good for him. You mentioned he would only pay a few hundred dollars for these planes. Why so cheap?
Well, a couple different reasons. First was nobody really wanted these airplanes. They were surplus. There was a lot of them coming back from the war effort. And there really wasn't a huge demand. So it was probably easier for the military just to scrap these rather than go into the airplane sales business. Now, the military did sell some of the planes, and it was often to returning fighter pilots who would race them at the national air races held every year, conveniently enough, in Cleveland. The price of these was determined by the scrap value at the time, and suddenly there was a lot of scrap planes left over, including some now almost priceless planes that were sent to the scrap heap.
So did he favor one kind of plane over the other?
You know, almost all of his collection was military. He loved military planes, and in particular, fighter planes. But the planes did range from a lot of fighters and often rare planes to a B-25 bomber, and that's a huge plane. Now, if you think about the logistics involved in dismantling a World War II bomber and put it on the back of a homemade trailer that you're going to take with your Chevy Suburban, that had to be quite a sight.
With bald tires and bad brakes.
Absolutely. So Walter, he also had a prototype North American XP-82 twin Mustang, then an F-82E twin Mustang with Allison engines, and an early jet-age Chance Vought F-7U Cutlass, and a prototype of the Douglas AD Sky Raider series. He also had a Super Corsair that was raced by local pilot Cook Cleland to first place in the 1947 Thompson Trophy race. Walter's son Wally also told of an epic journey to procure the B-25 bomber, and this is a cool story. So Walter and Wally, they're watching an episode of the TV show 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. Out of nowhere, Walter decided, well, hey, I want a B-25 bomber. So somebody gave him a little tip that led to the purchase of a B-25 for $500 from the Lunkin Airport in Cincinnati, and the journey began. This plane was to be the biggest plane he ever attempted to transport by himself with his meager equipment. And I'm going to read a passage here from the Wally Zapata book entitled The B-25 in My Backyard. And this particular passage describes the family's attempt to transport this plane.
This ought to be interesting.
This is good. On a Saturday in October, Dad, my three older sisters and I hit the road for Cincinnati before dawn. At 15, Rita was the oldest, with Barb and Margie filling in the 4-year gap between Rita and me. The 200-mile drive down to Cincinnati was a big adventure. We passed the early morning hours by playing games and singing 100 bottles of beer on the wall, as the Suburban had no radio. On the downside, the Suburban, with 5 aboard, was pretty cramped. Along with snacks, drinks, books, and blankets was all of Dad's equipment that he would need. Toolboxes, a stepladder, cables, chains, 2 bomb winches, a few jacks, and assorted wood blocks. In addition, there were spare parts for the Suburban, plus several spare tires, since the bald ones Dad drove on were prone to let go. Still, except for having to rest our feet on rusty toolboxes, we were comfy. When we reached Lunken Airport, Dad got permission to drive onto the ramp, and we parked next to the B-25. Despite the story of the belly landing, the bomber, basically intact, was standing on its landing gear. Dad's new airplane was in civilian markings, with the Federal Aviation Agency, as it was called back then, N number, on the rear fuselage. As the military turned civilian aircraft, it was missing its gun turrets and bomb racks, though we would discover armor-plated pilot seats and a big steel ring where the top gun turret had been installed. As expected, the belly landing had ripped much of the aluminum from the bottom of the fuselage. From watching war movies with Dad, I expected the propeller blades to be bent and curled, but only the prop on the left engine showed this kind of damage. On the cockpit side of the forward fuselage, Wild Cargo was crudely painted in big black letters. "I just can't believe it," Dad grinned. "It's like they made this plane to be hauled down the highway." He showed me all the major sections were bolted together in just the right places to allow damage-free disassembly. The forward fuselage could be unbolted in front of the wing and the aft fuselage behind the wing. The outboard wings unbolted just beyond the engines, and even the engine nacelles unbolted slightly aft of the wings. To Dad, the realization was learning that the airplane would not be sacrificed to the gods. What he most hated about hauling airplanes was that some had to be cut to fit on the highway, and if a major section of the structure was cut, the airplane would be difficult to put back together and to restore to flying condition. Dad was still in mourning over his first twin Mustang, the prototype XP-82. To haul it home, he had destroyed the wings by cutting it with a torch, only later to discover bolts in a different part of the structure that would have made the torch job unnecessary. He was sick about it. When he got his second twin Mustang, he had learned his lesson and hauled it without any cutting. For every airplane that followed the XP-82, Dad studied the airframe carefully before deciding to cut anything. Our quick study of the B-25 concluded, Dad went into general patent mode and got all of us busy turning wrenches and screwdrivers. Usually, I was the one with him on trips for airplanes, but on this trip, I appreciated having my sisters along. They proved to be a big help, especially Barb, who knew wrenches, sockets, and other tools by name, size, and use. Dad would come to describe this first trip as the easy load. We removed all the small components, the tail section, the wing flaps, the ailerons, landing gear doors, and bomb bay doors, loaded them all onto the trailer, and took them home. Dad had picked his words well. Nothing was easy after that. The first major disassembly we tackled was removing the outboard wings. From the outside, the wings looked relatively simply to remove, and Dad took just me to get them. Along the top and bottom of the wing joint, a long row of bolts stuck into the wing with their 9/16 head protruding. Easy job, we thought. We got on top of the left outboard wing. Dad started on the first bolt, which turned without much difficulty. But that was it. It turned and turned and turned, but didn't even begin to come out. Dad put his socket on another bolt and another with the same result. "Don't tell me they didn't put self-holding nut plates inside the wing," he exclaimed. We got off the wing, and soon Dad had his wobbly stepladder under it. Good news and bad. An air cooler was located at each wing joint with an access panel under the cooler. But the cooler bled thick black oil when removed, and after the cooler was removed, we could still not reach half the nuts for the wing bolts. Dad cut the rivets that held the air ducts for the air cooler. With the ducts removed, I was able to snake my skinny shoulders through the air cooler opening and into the wing. Struggling with claustrophobia plus the fear I'd get stuck inside the jagged structure, I spent hours contorted in the wing as I moved my wrench from one nut to the next while Dad spun the bolts out from the outside. When it came time to pull the last bolts and remove the wing, we had another problem that would confront us on most airplane hauling endeavors. We didn't have a crane or a lift. To solve this problem this time, Dad made a pair of H-shaped wooden frames to hold the wing as the bolts were removed. A genius at making a hard work easy by constructing something cheap and simple, Dad connected the H-frames to the trailer in a way that allowed them to fold down to the trailer. Using an old bomb winch to control the rate at which the H-frames folded, we lowered the wings to the trailer. Now we were halfway done with this part of the ordeal. We worked on the bomber every weekend that October and on into November. Many local aviation enthusiasts stopped by, and from them we learned a lot about the bomber, including the story of how the B-25 had ended up at Lunkin nearly 2 years earlier. As the story went, a man from Louisiana used the bomber to take a diverse collection of exotic animals from city to city, thus the name Wild Cargo. En route to Cincinnati for a show, the right engine had failed. The pilot reported to Lunkin Tower that his landing gear was inoperative and he declared an emergency. While the pilot circled Lunkin to burn fuel, the co-pilot parachuted out, an event that was captured on camera by local news teams. Despite having an engine out, no landing gear, and extreme crosswind, the pilot, by all accounts, made a perfect landing. After the wings, we tackled the rear fuselage. Though it wasn't that heavy, it was so long that we had more fuselage hanging off the trailer than riding on it. Making matters worse, we had the narrow end, the tail gunner position, of the fuselage on the front of Dad's two-wheeled trailer. Through this arrangement, it allowed us to get the narrow tail cone up close to the Suburban's rear doors to allow room for turning. It also meant the wide and heavy end of the fuselage was sticking far beyond the back of the trailer. On the highway, the load handled badly and was prone to sway left and right, limiting our speed to about 40 miles an hour. On another trip, we put both of the airplane's twin-row R2600 radial engines on the trailer together. Though the load was well-balanced, the engines were very heavy. It was bad enough we didn't have a truck, but even worse, Dad's Suburban wasn't too powerful. It sported a straight six engine with a three-speed transmission that shifted on the steering column. Today, people wouldn't use a vehicle like that to pull a jet ski. And here we were, dragging a World War II bomber 200 miles. The last 20 miles of our journey consisted of some big hills in Ohio Chagrin's Valley, and Dad was nervous with good reason. While pulling the pair of B-25 engines up one of the hills, he had trouble downshifting into first gear. Halfway up the hill, we almost stalled out, with the Suburban built before the age of power brakes and no brakes on the trailer. I later had nightmare about those heavy bomber engines taking us for a rip-roaring, backward ride down that long, steep hill. The center section of the wing with both engine nacelles had both main landing gear and the bomb bay, which proved to be the heaviest and most unstable load of all. Still, it represents the last load. Approaching the dreaded hill, Dad shifted into first gear while we were still on flat pavement. To our relief, the Suburban's little six was up to the task, though just barely. Well past midnight when we got home, Dad cruised from our dirt driveway out into the field next to it. Under the light of the stars, he parked the trailer and center wing section behind the cockpit, to some extent reuniting the shadowy silhouettes altogether. And with that, A stray dog, B-25, once hours away from the Scrapman's Torch, had found a new home.
You know, that's an amazing story. This guy, he had to be crazy. You could never do that today. Can you imagine transporting this stuff on a highway? I mean, the highway patrol would be all over you in a second.
Yes, I would imagine the highway patrol would not take too kindly to see a B-25 bomber rolling around the Ohio Turnpike on the back of a Chevy Suburban. I agree.
Oh, my God. It would be a nightmare. And, you know, getting down to 40 miles an hour, I think you mentioned at one point. I don't know. It sounded pretty dangerous. But he did it. So good for him. So whatever became of Walter and all these planes?
Great question. So Walter's collection would begin to enjoy a bit of notoriety. And there are stories that the local hardware stores and gas stations in the area, they would offer photocopied maps showing directions to the airplane place in the 1960s and 70s. So it would show these people how to, this place had gained so much notoriety and so many people knew about it. They were handing out, maps at the local gas stations. Here's how you get to the supplies place.
The airplane place, right?
The airplane place. Now, Walter would sometimes offer tours on Sundays. Now, again, he loved aviation, had a passion for it, and loved sharing it with other people. So good for him. And it was often routine that 30 or more people would show up to tour his collection. However, soon trespassers would become a problem, with vandalism and liability becoming a concern, and soon he became very private and protective of his planes. He would stop adding to the fleet in the 1970s, and Walter would ultimately pass in 2010. I'm not sure if this guy will ever get his due. He single-handedly rescued so many of these planes from the scrap heap and saved them from being destroyed. Walter's son, Wally, tells of a story of them traveling a long way, hundreds of miles, only to learn that a plane was due to be cut up in 30 minutes before the supplies arrived. So they really rescued it from the scrap heap. As for the planes, this is where the story gets good. There was a rumor that Walter had collected so many instruments from the many airplanes that the radium from the dials collectively exceeded the EPA threshold for radioactivity, and Walter had gathered these in his house. And so this radioactivity essentially declared his house uninsurable and uninhabitable. Now imagine, you have so many airplane dials and so many instruments that it not your house that you live in is now declared inhabitable. There's too much radioactive. That is crazy.
It is crazy.
So Walter would build another house on site for his wife and his children. They would never return back to the house, but that was just kind of how the guy was. It was said Walter used the house for storage anyway. So he stopped collecting the airplanes back in the 1970s. He would also openly dump gallons of motor oil over airplane parts in order to prevent them from rusting. Soon the community began to wonder exactly what would become of the airplane place, and some people wanted to hold true to Walter's vision, while others merely thought of it as a blight on the community. In the end, the Suplata family began to sell and donate a large chunk of Walter's collection, and all went to either museums with the intent to restore them or returning them to flying status. The P-80 is owned by the National Museum of Naval Aviation in Pensacola, Florida. The F-82E Twin Mustang is being restored to airworthiness in Minnesota. The F-2G Corsair belongs to the Cleveland Auto Aviation Museum and is being partially restored for static display while awaiting funds for its completion. The status of a basket case P-51 sold in the 1980s remains undetermined.
So his legacy lives on. I think that's great that these planes were brought to other places, they're being restored, they're being displayed. Like I said, his legacy lives on. That's awesome.
Now, I'd never been to Walter Suplata's place, even though I'm kind of an aviation guy. I never made it over there. This was a little bit before my time. But it's kind of neat to see all these planes now kind of scattered throughout the country and to see that the museums are restoring them. It's really making Walter Suplata's dreams come true. So kind of a cool, happy ending to the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the most important part is that they when they took these planes off of his land, they didn't travel down the highway. I think they found better means of transporting him to these other destinations, wouldn't you say?
I would say. Now, there is a cool, in researching the story, I found one little story when he went to pick up that B-25 bomber. When they said that he was allowed to drive on the airplane tarmac, the aviation brass, they were all there waiting for him to pick it up. And when this guy rolls in with a Chevy Suburban, you know, they're looking for trailers. They're looking for teams of men to disassemble. When this one guy shows up, they were incredulous. They couldn't believe this guy and his son are going to take apart this airplane, but he does it. So it's kind of a neat thing that this one guy with just passion, enduring love of aviation, he made this airplane collection his, and his legacy lives on. I think it's a cool story.
It's a great story. I'm so glad you, thanks for sharing it. It's awesome.
Absolutely. So if you are an airplane guy, I think there might be one or two airplanes still left over there. So if you're ever traveling in Ohio or over Northeast Ohio, look down over the town of Newberry and see if there's still some planes left there.
Actually, you know what? I have relatives that live in Newberry. I should ask them if they're familiar with where this might be. And do you know where it is exactly?
It's on the eastern side of Newberry. It's kind of out in the country. It shouldn't be hard to find. I think 82 acres, I think it was, he was rolling with, but kind of a cool story.
Yeah, I'm kind of familiar with Newberry, but not that particular exactly where this is at. But that's interesting. I'll have to check it out. That's great.
Yeah, just another cool story from another motivated guy in Northern Ohio. I think it's cool.
Thanks for sharing.
Absolutely. Thank you, and talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more like it, head over to OhioMysteries.com. With over 500 podcasts to choose from, there's sure to be one that's going to keep you captivated. I'm Dan, and I can be found at YouTube at North Coast History and Haunts. My partner Mike can be found at Facebook at Too Late for Autographs. Thanks for listening. That was another episode of Ohio Mysteries Backroads. Stay tuned for more.
You might be surprised to know that not all serial killers are straight, cisgender white men. And the victims of true crime are not a monolith either. She's Wendy and I'm Beth, and together we host Fruit Loop's Serial Killers of Color, a true crime podcast.
Together we take deep dives into the true crime stories about marginalized and minoritized perps and victims that often go untold.
We also provide the context and nuance that these stories deserve. At Fruit Loops, we're serving up true crime with a side of history, society, culture, and some fun.
Listen to Fruit Loop Serial Killers of Color on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.